of Ivorian funds and tax revenues. Ophébie Aquistarkton, NPR News, Abidjan.
United Airlines has been temporarily grounding nearly 100 of its jetliners so maintenance checks on computers aboard the Boeing 757 aircraft can be completed. The grounding has caused a number of flight cancellations and delays. Megan Callahan told WBBM-TV she didn't get the word of the delays until she was already at Chicago's O'Hare Airport yesterday.
I wish they would have called and alerted their customers.
The maintenance checks could affect some United flights today as well. An Amtrak passenger is being held on $100,000 bail after causing a commotion on a train in Montana. Authorities say the passenger made a threat that led to the train's evacuation. Passengers were taken to a nearby middle school where they spent the night in sleeping bags on air mattresses. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Whole Foods Market, committed to changing the way people shop for meat. Whole Foods Market, the more you know, the better. WholeFoodsMarket.com/meat.
Illinois Governor Pat Quinn lays out his spending priorities for the next year when he delivers his budget address to a joint session of the General Assembly today. I'm Sean Crawford of Illinois Public Radio. Join us for coverage and analysis.
Listen to the speech live at noon today on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. There are a great many American households today that include at least one companion animal. And in significant numbers, if you ask people about the animals they live with, they will tell you that they consider these animals to be like a family member. Sometimes they might even say it's like they're like their children. And given the importance of animals in our lives, it is no surprise, should be no surprise, that disputes over things like housing, veterinary malpractice, even custody issues may end up in litigation. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the evolving nature of animal law. And our guest for the program is Rebecca Huss. She's professor of law at Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana. She's visiting the campus. She gave a talk yesterday, and this is part of a Center for Advanced Study initiative for 2010-2011, Knowing Animals, Histories, Strategies, and Frontiers in Human-Animal Relations. And there have been a number of talks in the series and will be some more. We've had a chance to speak with some of these people, have them here on the show, bring them to a little bit larger audience, and we're pleased that she could be here this morning and spend some time with us. As we talk, as always, questions are welcome. We do ask people to try to keep their questions on the topic and try to be brief so we can keep things moving along. But to anybody who is listening can call in 333-9455. That's the number. Toll free 800-222-9455. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that too. And the address is will-talk. That's just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you're welcome to be a part of the conversation. And thanks very much for being here.
I appreciate you having me.
Well, just to start out and establish our territory here, I think probably if people hear the phrase animal law, certain things will come to mind. They no doubt will think about the continuing debate, conversation about animal rights. And that's maybe one set of things. Mm-hmm. There's the whole issue of animal welfare and the desire that animals are treated humanely. But in your work, those are really are kind of separate issues. So when you think about animal law, where are your interests here?
I actually define animal law as quite simply anything to deal with animals and it's in a relationship with the law. So some of the topics you talked about before, custody, estate planning, veterinary malpractice, it can be issues relating to wildlife or agricultural animals, but it doesn't necessarily make a moral judgment as to how we're treating the animals. Animal rights is a totally separate topic. There are certainly attorneys that practice what it would be referred to as animal rights law. It's just not what I do.
This, I think it's interesting because as you have written, and I'm sure people will know, there are a lot of people who have companion animals, and their animals are very important to them. And this relationship is increasingly important. We're thinking more and more about it. And maybe, again, not surprising that legal issues are in a lot of areas are going to come up.
Right. And one of the issues that I talk a lot about in my writing is the fact that we think of these animals as more than just another piece of property, although under the law, oftentimes that's how they're treated. Mm-hmm. And so we need to think as a society about whether the law adequately or accurately reflects the bond we have with these animals. Obviously, our companion animals especially do have some protection that the chairs we're sitting on don't. Mm-hmm. You know, there are anti-cruelty laws. You know, enforcement of them is somewhat challenging sometimes. And so there are some special protections for this particular type of property under the law. But for many people, it just doesn't reflect what they truly mean to them.
Yeah. Well, that, I think, points to a very interesting question, and that is, how does the law regard an animal? As you say, I think traditionally, maybe in many ways still, the law would consider the animal a piece of property.
Exactly.
It would be like a piece of furniture. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, we do have laws that say you can't abuse animals. We try to provide for their welfare.
Mm-hmm.
So then that raises the question, well, is the animal a piece of property? Is it like a chair? Or being a sentient being, does it in fact have some inherent right to a certain kind of treatment?
Exactly. And that's really the crux of the debate here, because there is a whole lot of people that do think of their animals as having an inherent value in and of themselves. Certainly the value of them is not the value they'd get on the open market. But the law doesn't reflect that conversation at this point. And so we see maybe changes on the edges, allowing people to make provisions for their animals in an enforceable way under an enforceable pet trust is one example that many states, over 41 states, have actually done that at this point. It does still go to the fact that there is an owner of that animal. And certainly there's theoretical ideas that have been presented out there to try to separate this type of property with other types of property, make it living property, or to otherwise treat it as a property with an intrinsic value. The legal system's not very well set up to do that, though. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we see some of the edges moving off. For example, under traditional common law, if your property is damaged, you're given the fair market value of that property up to the value of the property. So that doesn't work very well in a veterinary malpractice, not a veterinary malpractice case, but any case where you have veterinary expenses. So, for example, there was a recent case here in Illinois where a dachshund was attacked by a neighbor's dog, and the people who had the dachshund spent over $4,000 in veterinary costs. Well, the value of the dachshund on the fair market was about $200. But they were successful in arguing that the value of the dachshund was really the $4,000+, and the court granted that veterinary expenses as a damages, which is, you know, it sounds pretty straightforward to you and I, maybe, or some of our listeners, but that's actually a really significant change in how we deal with damage to this special type of property.
Mm-hmm. Well, that raises, I suppose you can push that, you push your hypothetical a little further, and you say, imagine some set of circumstances under which an animal is lost. Mm-hmm. Right? That is, the animal dies. And if you apply the same thing, if you apply fair market value, you would say, well, the value of the animal might be, you know, indeed, what would cost you to go out and get another one? So it
right.
might be. So say it's a purebred dog. So maybe it's a few hundred dollars.
Right.
But then when you say to that person, well, what's the value of this animal to you?
Mm-hmm.
And they could well say, well, priceless. And
American Express commercial, exactly.
They would say, or at least they would say, well, how could I put, you know, it's like you were asking me to put a dollar value on a mm-hmm. child or a spouse,
right.
which I suppose courts do in fact have to do.
For humans.
For humans. How does the law approach that same question when we're talking about, say, we're talking about a companion?
They say no, is what they do. There's been a few cases, certainly people try to argue loss of companionship and other other arguments that have been used for the loss of family members. But to date, it's been quite unsuccessful. What the next step really would be is to allow for non-economic damages, your pain and suffering because of the loss of your animal. And in most cases, in most states, because it's very state law based, that's not happening. The common law just doesn't support it. One interesting thing about the law here in Illinois is there's actually a statute that provides for extensive damages if somebody injures or kills your animal. The issue, though, is you have to show that there was an incident of aggravated cruelty or torture in order to utilize that statute for civil recovery. And honestly, that's a very difficult thing to show because that's an intentional criminal act that you're showing. So legislation can provide some relief in that area. The common law doesn't really do a very good job with it. Let's face it, the common law didn't provide for parents to recover on the death of their children for many, many years. And so it's going to take a long time, I think, for that next step to happen. But I shouldn't, you know, it's possible it could happen. It's just very difficult.
Well, I mentioned that you had given this talk on the evolving nature of animal law. And I think this illustrates the point that the way that that people think about animals, the way that the law regards them, they think about their relationship, is indeed changing.
And it has changed.
And has. So one could well expect that there would be further change.
Exactly.
And who knows
in
a decade how we'd be thinking about this.
Oh, I totally agree. And certainly the fact that we teach animal law now in the law schools and people talk about these issues, we have Illinois has a state bar association animal law section. The conversation is out there. You know, common law is not the only route we can take. We can take a legislative route. You know, I certainly have seen a lot of changes, even, you know, some people would say, oh, what's the big deal about having an enforceable pet trust? Well, 10 years ago, you didn't have an enforceable pet trust statute and you couldn't prepare, you know, for what would happen to your animals after your death, unless you just trusted people to do what you asked them to do. It might not actually make sense for that many people to utilize it because of tax concerns. And, you know, maybe you do have that trustworthy sibling that will take your dog and treat them the way you would want them to be treated the rest of their natural lives. But for just from a perspective of thinking about how the law can be changed, it's a great example.
Yeah. That is really interesting. How did that change that? And that would seem like quite a big change. How did that happen?
Well, the interesting thing about the pet trust statute is because it really talks about the human's interest. The human have an interest in protecting the lives of their animals, and it's the owned animals of the human. It was less of a, you know, theoretical or psychological change. It was more just trying to get around some of the archaic language that we have in our probate code. The law students out there in property class with the rule against perpetuities, and you know, I apologize to the listeners who aren't lawyers, but that is nightmarish for law students and lawyers all over the place. So think about it from that perspective. For most people, why would you care if somebody has an enforceable pet trust? You know, obviously there's potential tax issues, but if you're willing to pay the tax issues on that. The other issue is, honestly, once a few states go down the road, it's much easier for other states. Illinois, for example, didn't pass its law until 2005, so it wasn't really on the forefront of that. But once Illinois passed, then Indiana passed. So, you know, if you get people kind of thinking about it, it makes sense. The other issue from a pet trust statute perspective is we want to encourage people to plan for their animals because if they don't, they end up in shelters. And, you know, that's not a good resolution from a public policy perspective. Just like we want people to plan on what would happen to their animals in the event of a disaster, we want them to do that in the event something would happen to them.
Yeah. I think that's also interesting. Here's yet another dimension that I know that you're interested in, and that is the issue of what happens with animals, companion animals, when for whatever reason the animals, people, the animals, humans, can't take care of them anymore.
Right.
So it could be death, could be some variety of circumstances. And then this goes to the system that we have of taking care of those animals, which is already very overburdened.
Exactly.
And so you want to think, well, what could you possibly do in the way of advanced planning in a variety of circumstances so that that animal is taken care of, and it doesn't end up being in this already overburdened
right.
system.
Now, I'm going to actually recommend that folks go to Professor Gary Beyer, B-E-Y-E-R's website. He's in Texas, and he does a great amount of work in the pet trust area, and he's got some wonderful resources on his faculty webpage talking about planning for your animal, and everything from having a card in your wallet saying, in the case of emergency, please call so-and-so. That person has to have a key to your house. So if you get in a car accident, somebody's going and feeding your cats or your dogs or whatever other domestic animals you have, to the types of things you need to think about if something would happen to you, just setting it out in a pretty straightforward way. You know, food, when they had their vet care, just like if you were going on a trip, have that always out there and available, because you don't want there not to be a plan. If the animal ends up in a shelter, you know, in many cases, it's just not a good outcome for the animal.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Rebecca Huss. She's professor of law in the School of Law, Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana. And she, among other things, she is interested in animal law. And she was here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, gave a talk about the evolving nature of animal law. This was yesterday, and it was good enough to come and spend some time with us. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, now I'm curious about you, because I look at your background and I see that you teach on things like mergers and acquisitions and securities regulation,
right,
and business planning, law, and among all these other things is animal law.
Right.
How did you get into that?
Well, I was hired to teach the business classes, no shock there. And one of the wonderful things about the academic life is that as long as you're writing about something legal and academic, you can really explore lots of areas. And, you know, given the amount of time academics spend on their research and writing, after, you know, writing the requisite business law article, I decided, let me focus on something I'm really passionate about. And it's really been quite a privilege to be able to work in this area and have my school support my work in it.
And is this passion come out of personal experience?
Well, certainly, you know, like many, many people, I grew up with a family dog and have dogs of my own. And they're important parts of my members of my family, like you were saying in the introduction. And my family now lives on acreage, which supports larger animals. So I get to go and muck out stalls to bring me back to reality every once in a while. And I think I'm just very fortunate that I've been around people that have had me think about things a little bit. And honestly, it's just since it's an emerging area of the law, there's just so many ways to go and so many paths to take. It's just, like I said, very fortunate that I'm an academic and I'm able to do it.
Yeah. Another area that I think would be interesting to talk about, it has to do with the ability of or attempt of the extent to which government tries to regulate what sort of animals that people might have,
right,
in their home,
right,
on their,
right,
property. And certainly all, you know, I'm sure that many governmental entities do indeed have rules about, mm-hmm, about what you can have. And that always, I'm sure, then raises questions about there being some sort of competing rights here,
right,
between,
right,
the individual and what they would want and between, say, the city or the state and what it wants.
Right. And, you know, I have to be a little bit law professorial here. The case that most of the time we talk about is an actually 1897 case called the Centel case that said, people, yes, it's a property right you have, just like other property rights you have, but it's a qualified right. And the standard that's used for this qualified right and your ability to have it is subject to the exercise of police power, that basic police power for the public health, safety, and public morals. And all the government needs to do is say that there's show that there's a rational basis for this restriction. So that's why governments, state and local governments, can say, we don't want you to have, you know, a Bengal tiger on your property. We have a rational reason why we think this is not appropriate for this area of, you know, our state or our municipality. And so because of that, they can do that. And that's essentially the standard. Is actually rational basis is the lowest standard you need to meet. So it's pretty easy for municipalities and other governmental authorities to show that they have a valid reason to not allow you to have a particular type of animal on your property.
But that, I think, though, that gets at one of the questions that I had in my mind was, does the law recognize that there is some sort of right? That is, the individuals have that there is some sort of right of companion animal ownership or of animal ownership?
Well, it's a property right like any other property right, and it's subject to due process, constitutional due process. But it's been pretty firmly established that a post-seizure review of a seizure of an animal in situations where they're seizing animals is generally acceptable, as long as you're doing it in a way that's not discriminatory. And so, again, because of the qualified nature of this property, it might not be quite as I'm trying to think of a good word to say it's not quite as strong of a right, maybe, or it's not it's not a fundamental right. And in fact, there have been cases where people who have dogs or particular breeds of dogs have tried to argue that they should be a protected class, and the courts have all said, no, you're not special in any way because, as I say, you're animal folks, you know, and I include myself in that category.
Yeah. That's an issue I want to come back to, but I have a caller here. Rather than make them wait,
okay,
let's bring them into the conversation. Someone who's listening in Indiana and on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. Hopefully this will be a sensible question. A number of years ago, particularly in the late 70s, early 80s, you couldn't open the Philosophy Journal without having two or three articles on animal rights. I never got real involved in that because my interest in philosophy are mostly in philosophy and mathematics and logic. But I was just wondering whether or not any of that actually trickled down and informed the legal community about certain arguments they could use to push things one way or other, you know, in regards to animal ownership and things like that, if you ever come across that in your teachings, or whether that was just one of those corners of philosophy. We had a lot of fun with each other for 12, 15 years, and that was the end of it.
Well,
secondly, I'd like to throw this in and I'll hang up. My animal shelter, I've got a black lab who gets out all the time, and you've got 72 hours to save that animal's life. If you don't make it, it's dead. Okay, thanks a lot.
No, thank you.
Well, let me respond to the second issue first. The holding period of 72 hours, that's actually pretty standard. And one of the issues that animal activists are concerned about is providing for shelters to have to take positive action. Many times the law would provide that if there's a tag, and I would certainly encourage everyone to microchip their animals, because shelters are usually required to scan for microchips and try to reunite with their original humans. But that's pretty standard, and one of the things people are concerned about is the fact that in many situations the animals are euthanized before people either have the time. You know, some animals can get pretty far away, or if they're traveling, it can be a real problem. As to the more theoretical philosophical question, the answer is we're still having a lot of fun with it. There is, I would say, arguably a divide among animal activists, not necessarily people who are involved in animal law, between the abolitionists and the welfarists. The abolitionists would be what you might think of as animal rights activists, that they say stop utilizing animals for all purposes now, and trying to do incremental change is actually harmful to animals in the long run. And the welfarists say, listen, we might have the same goal at the end, but the means are different, and we want to change the lives of the animals that are here today. And when you ask whether it informs our thought process and how we think about the law, I certainly think it does. Certainly the referendum that we've seen in some states relating to agricultural animals is a great example of that. You know, for many people involved, they might not think that it's appropriate that, you know, we consume a particular type of animal. But the first step of getting pigs out of gestation crates is part of that process. So the caller is correct. There certainly is some philosophical basis for thinking about these things. Translating that to what the law actually says is challenging, as it is in any type of the law.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus is Rebecca Huss. She's professor of law at Valparaiso University. She's visiting the campus. We're talking about animal law, one of her particular areas of academic interest. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk at illinois.edu. I want to come back to this area of breed-specific legislation, because I know this is also something that is interesting to you, and that we have seen cases where maybe within a particular jurisdiction they have said, well, having a dog is fine. You can have a dog, provided, of course, you meet certain qualifications, you have them vaccinated, and
right,
you don't let them run wild and stuff. But they would say, except for particular breeds. And they might say, you can have anything you want except this one.
Right.
And people would argue that that's, wrongheaded for a variety of reasons.
Right.
What does the law say about that? And do people challenge that notion that you could have the ability to have widespread ownership of an animal with certain exceptions?
Right. Well, like you said, for a lot of reasons, I don't think it's an appropriate and effective governmental regulation. There's more and more studies showing that it's not an effective governmental regulation. If we're concerned about public safety, which is a valid and legitimate public concern, let's get effective, dangerous dog regulations in place. And in fact, a lot of people in this area say, well, it's really more responsible owner regulations. If you are letting your dog run at large, if you're letting your dog go unsterilized, because we do know the connection between bites and unaltered animals, that's really the issue. As far as the law goes, if the statute is drafted appropriately, not vague, and followed without discriminatory intent, again, it's usually considered valid under the law. This is a very individual state law issue. Some states say you can't have breed discriminatory legislation. Other states you can, and then individual municipalities do it. One thing that people always have to be sensitive to is that even in states that might have a law that says you can't have a breed ban, the jurisdictions that had a breed ban in effect or breed-specific legislation or breed discriminatory legislation might not even be a ban. It might just be a requirement that you have a certain amount of liability insurance that honestly is very difficult for people to get, or other restrictions with that particular breed of animal. And I have to say, it's not just one particular breed. It's actually quite a few breeds that you might even be surprised about. So I think there is a little bit of a slippery slope argument, too, that people are concerned about. But my point is that even if you're in a state that doesn't allow a breed ban, almost, it's very common, and I know it's happening right now here in Illinois, that there's laws that are proposed to allow for it. So, for example, I was informed last night that there's a bill right now in the House Committee on Agriculture that's considering it. And so if people are concerned about that, they should let their representatives know.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I'm curious because I was thinking primarily about laws aimed at pit bulls because people think that they're dangerous.
Just because of the myths.
And sadly, as you say, I think that also, though a lot of other folks would argue, this is not an animal, this is not a dog problem, this is a human problem.
Exactly.
But are there other breeds that
have been very common. Chows, huskies, even German shepherds sometimes, and so there's jurisdictions that don't even just restrict on breed, but restrict on weight or size. So people have to be, first of all, before you move anywhere, make sure you check out your local ordinance, not just for breed bans or breed restrictions, but also for numerical bans and numerical limitations, because some people really get caught off guard and get into trouble. I do want to make a point about the breed restrictions. The Department of Justice just went through a rulemaking process for the Americans with Disabilities Act regulations, and they looked at their service animal definition again. And one of the things they talked about is whether they should allow jurisdictions to incorporate their breed bans as to service animals. And the Department of Justice said no. They said in the guidance on the regulations that they didn't think that was an appropriate justification based on stereotypes. And if a jurisdiction and there's an individual with a disability with a service animal in that is a banned breed or restricted breed, they have to look at the individual animal, the individual dog, and look at that dog's history, not based on stereotypes or, any myths about the history of the breed of dog itself, which is honestly very, heartening, I think, for people who have been fighting these breed discriminatory laws, to have the Department of Justice say, you have to look at the individual animal, which is all people really want. Most of the people that are the most strict about dangerous dogs are people who do rescue work, because they don't want those dangerous dogs out on the street either. They know that one dangerous dog can ruin it for all the other ones.
Yeah. And certainly the problem that they're just makes the problem that they're trying to address that much worse.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting because I'm sure that, for example, again, say with the pit bull, I'm sure that there are a lot of people in this country that own pit bulls, think that they're wonderful animals. Mm-hmm. And the issue is just, you know, that any animal can be dangerous if it's abused, if it's maltreated.
Well, and if it's out of control, you know, one of the things that one of the sayings, every dog has a capacity to bite. And that's very true. Every dog does have the capacity to bite. It's really up to us as the people who have the animals in our lives to be responsible about our management of them.
Yeah. Well, let me then ask you about a story that I think is quite interesting that I know you've ended up talking about a lot. And this maybe goes back a couple of years. People will recall the case of the professional football player Michael Vick, who was he was a quarterback for the Atlanta Falcons. In the summer of 2007, he was charged with being involved in an interstate dogfighting operation. And he indeed did plead guilty, served some time in prison. And he's still a football player. He's in Philadelphia now. But you became involved in this because the attorneys who were prosecuting this case were concerned about the dogs that were involved. And so you ended up being called in and you ended up being appointed, in a sense, the guardian of the animals because apparently the hope was that they really didn't want to see the dogs destroyed. Their question was, is it possible that these animals could be saved? And they called you in to help with that.
Right. My official title was guardian / special master, a little unwieldy. But the U.S. Attorney's Office asked me if I would act in that capacity. And keep in mind that there had been a lot of people that had been educating the folks there since the case started about the fact that there were options for these dogs. And so the ASPCA put together an evaluation team at the beginning of September and evaluated these dogs and found that they actually, many of them, you know, could go straight into a foster home environment. And then there was others at different levels that they'd need to be different levels. And the government really just wanted somebody to interact with, like I would say, the animal folks and talk with the rescue organizations and determine what I would recommend to the court as far as placement of the dogs. And so that was my role, is to interact with the rescue organizations and decide on an individual basis after the individual evaluations, all about individuals, what dog would be best with which organization. And ultimately, of the 48 dogs that I started with in the process, one, unfortunately, had to be euthanized for medical reasons during the process. That was the dog we named Rose. And then 47 dogs went to 8 different rescue organizations around the country. And it really is quite amazing, not just because these dogs survived the process when ordinarily they would have just been euthanized, but because it's meant that there's been a basis for allowing for individual evaluation and potential placement, if appropriate placements are available, for dogs in other circumstances. So as an example, in July 2009, there was a huge multi-state dogfighting bust, 500 animals. And, you know, although percentage-wise the number of animals in that bust weren't placed as high as is in the Bad News Kennels case, about 60-some percent of the animals were placed, that's still better than 100% being euthanized. And another really good thing that just happened on Monday was the American Bar Association House of Delegates approved a recommendation that provides for the humane treatment and disposition of animals in seizures. So that's really exciting that we're essentially changing the protocol or changing the model of how we treat animals in large-scale seizures, whether they're dog fighting or a hoarding case or any basic seizure situation.
Yeah. So one of the articles I read about this, the impression I got was when you were first contacted, you were a little bit hesitant because it was not something that you had ever
dealt
with.
Well, no one had really done it.
Nobody had.
Exactly.
You were being drafted to do something that nobody had ever done.
Right. And I was quite hesitant, and I definitely hadn't reached out to anybody to try to get the gig. But obviously, it was tremendously rewarding. It had an amazingly positive outcome, and it could have been a very different outcome. So everybody involved was very pleased that it turned out the way it was.
Yeah. One of the articles that right up at the top that I looked at, there's a picture of you and one of these dogs, one of these pit bulls, and you're kind of hugging the dog. It looks like the dog's head is bigger than your head.
I don't remember the dog's head being that big, but I think the camera angle is just a little bit odd. The dogs actually ranged in weight from about 35. We had a few that were, you know, in the upper 60, you know, but a lot of the dogs weren't that large, and I think that was just a bad picture.
It looks a little scary.
But the thing is, and people have asked me if I ever felt, you know, unsafe. First of all, I was with a member of Bad Rap, which is a pit bull rescue organization. And so I was with the experts. I mean, I said from the beginning, I'm a law professor. I'm, you know, a lawyer. I'm here to do this aspect of it. But I needed to interact with the caretakers of the dogs because there had been a gap between when the dogs had brought in, when the evaluation occurred, and when I was going through my process. And so we needed to have continued information. And honestly, the best part, you know, the most rewarding part of the whole process for me was, you know, interacting with the dogs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk with somebody here locally in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question, comment about a different species, and that would be the horse. The recent recession has really caused a lot of economic distress for horse owners and horse breeders and the horse industry. And rescue organizations are vastly overloaded, in part because slaughter is not an option, and I'm not saying that slaughter should be an option, but it's not an option in the U.S. anymore. I'm on the board of directors of the Institute for the Desert Arabian Horse, and we have a rescue part of our mission. We've been inundated with people who want to place their horses, and they are the ones who are forethoughtful. Too many people die without providing for their horses, or they get sick and the horses get neglected, and it causes a lot of economic duress for rescue organizations, and it also causes these animals to be very dangerous because a neglected horse is, you know, 900 or 1,200 pounds of uncontrolled mass. So I would like, and I guess my question is, the horse in modern society is no longer a draft animal, no longer a conveyance, but its role has changed in modern society, and yet it's still considered an agricultural livestock. Some people want it to be reclassified as companion animal, and most horse breeders and people in the horse industry do not want that. However, there is this sort of void in the law and regulations concerning the place of the horse in modern society, and I was wondering if you have a comment on that.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, equines are really a category in and of themselves because they are in between. For, as you said, for many people, they're a companion animal, and they're a wonderful companion animal. They have a relationship with them that is something very special. You're right. There is this issue in the law. I think the fact that there was the action taken to ban slaughter here in the United States, although it's a little more complicated than that, and I don't want to overstate that, is because we here in the United States don't find it socially acceptable to consume horse meat. And you're right, the issue is very serious. I would go back to your initial discussion about people who haven't planned for what would happen to the equine. Like you said, during these current economic times, and especially the last few years, the horse rescues have just been inundated, and it's really been a huge problem. And I think that it's such an important thing to do to plan ahead for your equine or your other companion animal that I would just encourage people to think about what would happen if something made them lose part of their income. Because, you know, you can probably tell the listeners about the true cost of having a horse. It's not just throwing out a bale of hay to them every once in a while. There's tremendous cost for boarding and inappropriate care for them. I would encourage people to think about whether it's appropriate for them to start with an equine if they're not prepared to treat the equine appropriately throughout the equine's life, or at least plan on what would happen if they couldn't care for the animal.
Yes. And, you know, just even things like getting regular training and
right.
so that the animal is safe for other people to...
Exactly. Manage. Exactly. Again, proper management is really
proper
the key.
Proper management, yes. Thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left. A little bit more in this part of Focus. Rebecca Huss is our guest. She's professor of law at Valparaiso University. We're talking about animal law, and that is really we're talking about the, as I'm sure she would say, it's about the bond between humans and their companion animals and how the law does either reflect or not reflect that bond, and how that has changed over time. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We do have an email from somebody who is interested in whether you could talk about what kind of work and how much work would be available for attorneys who would specialize in these kind of things.
Well, I have to say, here in the Midwest, it's not quite as prevalent as on the coast, but there's definitely pro bono opportunities for people. We don't see as much of paid work yet. The valuation issue for animals, because of the common law that we talked about before, generally people have a hard time making a living just as an animal lawyer at this point, unless you're working for an animal welfare organization. And I have to say the opportunities in the organizational front have actually increased substantially over the last 5 years. So if you're interested in that, you should definitely keep your eyes open for that. There's pro bono opportunities through organizations like the Animal Legal Defense Fund that, although they're based in California, they have pro bono opportunities all over the United States, and they're at ALDF.org. I would strongly encourage anybody interested in animal law to join the American Bar Association Animal Law Committee, which, of course, is a committee I'm active in. And Illinois also has a animal law section under the Illinois State Bar Association. And because of that, that's where people get information about cases and opportunities. So that would be a great place for people to start.
Another caller, Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. I saw a program recently on public TV about the animals that got shuffled around after Katrina, and there were some legal issues there because people were not able to come get them, obviously, within 5 days or whatever the limit is, and didn't even know where their animals were, and sometimes they were readopted, and then the person found the animal, and the new person refused to give it up, and there was a prevailing attitude with some of the rescue organizations that these animals had been neglected or abandoned, which I think is unfortunate, and that you know, these were poor people, and so they hadn't taken good care of their animals, whereas, you know, the film depicted the people as very, very dedicated to their animals and that they had gotten good care. And I wondered if you had looked into that issue at all.
Actually, I've not written too much about it, but I'm glad you brought it up because it's such an important issue. The estimates are that only 12 to 25% of people who lost a companion animal got a companion animal back, and that the numbers of animals that were lost during that process ranged dramatically from 50,000 to 200,000 animals. A couple things have happened since then. I agree, it's regrettable that there'd be any income test or any income disparity issue there, but a couple things. First, not that long after Katrina, the federal government passed what's called the PETS Act, P-E-T-S, that requires state and local governments to, when they do their disaster planning, plan for companion animals and service animals to avoid having something like that happen in the future. And most jurisdictions have done that. So there shouldn't be a large-scale issue like we saw after Katrina. And obviously, Katrina had all sorts of other issues. The other thing that we've done relates to your issue of getting the animals back. Again, the Animal Law Committee of the American Bar Association put together a model holding period statute. So in the event of a disaster, and there's levels of disaster, the animals have to be held for longer periods of time. And it's a more standardized period of time, because one of the issues that we saw after that disaster was no one really knew what would be you know, what's acceptable. And obviously, in that case, one of the issues was the people were so scattered and didn't have access to even the internet. And it was really an extraordinary situation that, you know, we certainly hope would never happen again. And there's more procedural things that have been put in place now to hopefully prevent that from happening again. I mentioned microchipping before. It is so important, you know, in a disaster situation, especially collars can get lost, but that microchip and keeping it up to date can really save an animal's life and reunite you with your lost pet if you ever lose one.
Okay. I think there was even one that was microchipped but wasn't returned to the owner.
Yeah, that's a very controversial issue, and certainly one of the things that the law doesn't do well is how long, even in a non-disaster situation, do you have to find the animal before somebody else has the animal and bonds with the animal? It's honestly just not something that the law has dealt with very well at this point.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have maybe about 5 minutes left. I was interested in the area of custody disputes and whether, in fact, I talked earlier about how in response to surveys, a lot of people who have companion animals say, well, they're like our children.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you would imagine that you have a couple, they're married, they have companion animal, they get a divorce. Some of the same questions that would be asked if we were talking about children, human children, would be asked about, you know, who gets the animal? Does someone have to pay support?
Right.
Does someone get visitation rights? Mm-hmm. Now, some people might dismiss that and say, oh, come on.
Silly, yeah.
That's silly.
Yeah.
But I'm confident that some such issues do come up.
And you are correct. The issue, it does come up fairly regularly. The law, again, doesn't very well approach this issue. There have been a few attempts to legislatively handle this issue to allow for courts to consider the best interest of the animal. Generally, courts don't want to deal with this issue, and it's up to the individuals to do private contracting either before the marriage or before the relationship or at the time of the dissolution to determine what they're going to do with the animal. The animal, because of its status as a legal property, often is dealt with in the property settlement, and then, of course, the judge doesn't come in and you know, deal with that again. We do see people on a fairly, you know, regular basis doing what you would call shared custody arrangements, and courts will uphold, many courts have upheld those types of agreements. The issue of financial support is usually tougher. An earlier caller talked about equines because of the amount of money that's needed just for basic care. We see more often in those types of situations. Usually, if one party gets full custody, as you would say, or gets essentially full ownership of the animal after the dissolution, we don't see any type of financial support because I think people are just at that point so grateful to get the animal that they just want to walk away from the situation. Hmm. It's actually an interesting situation. Again, the courts don't really want to deal with it. They don't feel the court opinions that talk about it say, you know, we're our resources are low. We don't feel like we have an expertise in this. And you know, the one thing courts will do is if they think there's abuse or if an animal is in danger, they've been good about not placing the animal with that person. And going to something not separate, mm-hmm. but different, one of the trends we're seeing is because of the link between abuse of animals and abuse of people, we're seeing more states put in laws that provide for domestic violence protection orders to include the animals.
Really?
And so that certainly helps, you know, obviously the not so amicable situations, to put it lightly.
Well, I think that there are some growing number of places where when people want to get a divorce, there is the requirement that they go through some kind of mediation.
Exactly.
And the hope is that if the marriage can't be saved, at least things like property issues, division of property and all those sorts of things, that I'm sure that the hope of the court is all of those things can be worked out
before they even see them. Exactly.
So that then when those people come to the court, the judge can sort of say, okay, fine, you got it worked out. Mm-hmm. Everybody in agreement. Happy landings. So I would expect that the people who are in the business of doing that mediation, then here's yet another thing that maybe 10
people
years
feel
ago,
very passionate about.
It wouldn't
exactly.
Come up.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. One other thing, we have maybe 3-4 minutes. We really haven't touched on it's getting back to. I'm interested in particularly when it comes to service animals.
Mm-hmm.
What the law says about what sort of rights individuals have to have their service animals with them, and whether that – what sort of problems that raises in housing, for example, and also in education, particularly for children who have service animals, and there's some kind of dispute about whether or not the child will be allowed to bring the animal into the classroom or not.
Right. And actually, the education issue is very topical here in Illinois because, again, you know, Illinois, you guys have done some good things. You have a provision in your school code that essentially just says service animals for a student with a disability may accompany them to all events, whether in or outside the classroom. And there's been a couple of recent cases of young boys, kindergarten, first graders, who are on the autism spectrum disorder wanting to bring their service animals to school. And ultimately, through the appellate court process, we found that the court says this is what the school code says. If the animal is indeed a service animal, if indeed the child has a disability, they have a right to have their service animal with them. So that's actually a very complicated topic because of the other laws relating to the education of students with disabilities. But Illinois has set forth, something a little bit different. I would say that we talked a little bit about service animals earlier. One thing that people should remember is that the definition of assistance animals for the Fair Housing Act, so your ability to have an animal in housing, is a broader right, at least according to what Housing and Urban Development says, than a service animal that has access to public accommodations. So there's some really great organizations that help individuals with disabilities. And as long as you're truly an individual with a disability and the animal meets that category, you should be able to have access.
Well, is there a lot of argument over what qualifies as a service animal, or is that pretty clear?
Well, that's one of the things the Department of Justice clarified, or at least reinforced, that a service animal under the Americans with Disabilities Act, so public accommodations, that animal has to do work or perform tasks and be individually trained. So essentially, the animal has to do something that in most cases means a physical task. It doesn't have to be guiding or pulling a wheelchair. It might be nudging. It can be certainly an animal, and we see more and more service animals being used for disabilities that aren't apparent disabilities. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a great example. But the animal still has to be individually trained to do work and perform tasks, and the animal has to act appropriately in a public arena as well.
Mm-hmm. So that's I think that's interesting, is we're seeing in some cases animals that what their function as in some levels, and I don't mean to underestimate or understate what the animals are doing, but it seems that on some levels their service is simply being there.
Right. That would be considered an assistance animal under the Federal Housing Act. And that's sometimes people call them emotional support animals. Yeah. And the key is you still need to have a disability and have the animal somehow alleviate a symptom of that.
Right. Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have maybe about a minute or so. We've gotten into a lot of different areas. I guess, again, the thing that I come around with at the end is sort of where we started, is that this is a growing and developing area. More and more lawyers and law schools are interested in it, and we should expect to see that grow, it's very much connected with how it is we are continuing to change the way we think about animals and our relationship with them.
As society changed, law must follow.
Yeah. And so anything that really – what are the really interesting issues that you say are sort of on the – horizon that you think will be coming up sometime soon?
Well, I think that from a public policy perspective, I think agricultural animals are something, obviously here in the Midwest, is something people are thinking a lot about. My personal focus is really on those companion animals and service animals. And in that area, I think the development of allowing more people with disabilities to have access with their assistance animals and housing is one that we're going to see more on as people get more educated about their rights.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Rebecca Huss. She's professor of law at Valparaiso University Law School. That's in Valparaiso, Indiana. She's here visiting the campus. She gave a talk yesterday on the campus as part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for 2010-2011, Knowing Animals, History, Strategies, and Frontiers in Human-Animal Relations. And I'm sure we'll have some more of these folks on the program in the weeks to come. Thanks very much for being
Thank
here.
You.
Support for Focus comes from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982 with four area locations, including inside the ARC, the Illini Student Union, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is available at bodyworkassociates.com.
Many thanks to the 314 listeners who made a pledge of support during our three-day mini-drive. You raised more than $39,000 for WILL, your local public radio station. And thanks to the Common Ground Food Co-op, their partnership provides generous support to both WILL and the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. This local partnership will provide nearly 1,900 meals to local families.
We'll break for an update on the markets and news. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City. We're seeing prices to the downside once again today, except for soybean oil and live and feeder cattle. Also, the hogs are now in positive territory. Let's look at particulars in Kansas City. March wheat trading at 928 and a quarter, down 15 and a quarter. May, 940, down 14 and a quarter. July, 948, down 15 and a half. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 827 and a quarter, down 13. May, 859 and a half, down 12 and three quarters. July, 887 and a quarter, down 12 and three quarters. March corn, 683 and a half, down 7. May, 693 and a half, down 7 and a half.